United States versus Presidio and Jean.
May it please the court, I'm Ann Hayes. I represent the appellant Stanley Presidio. Mr. Presidio's due process rights were violated because the district court accepted his guilty plea without an affirmative showing that he understood the nature of the charges against him. The record does not reflect that anyone ever advised Mr. Presidio of the elements of the charges to which he pleaded guilty, or that he had any understanding of the law in relation to the facts. The Supreme Court has stated unambiguously, before the district court accepts a guilty plea, there must be an affirmative showing that the plea was intelligent and voluntary, and the waiver of constitutional rights will not be presumed from a silent record. In fact, if a defendant's guilty plea is not equally voluntary and knowing, it's been obtained in violation of the due process rights and it's therefore void. And so the guilty plea can't be an admission of all the elements of a formal criminal charge if the defendant does not have an understanding of the law in relation to the facts.
Now, we've said in some cases that how much you have to tell a defendant sometimes depends on how complex the charges are. So how do you think this case fits into that paradigm or that principle?
I have a two-prong answer to that, Judge Jordan. First is the defendant was told nothing about this case. So his intelligence level, his ability to comprehend and discern information doesn't even come into play because nobody told him anything about the elements of the offense. The other thing that I have to say is that the elements of the charged offense were not self-explanatory, even if he had had the opportunity to hear information about what he was charged with, what the elements were. He was charged with bank fraud conspiracy, which that's not self-explanatory. The elements are that a conspiracy existed, the defendant knew of it, and he knowingly and voluntarily joined it. By simply being told the title of the offense, conspiracy to commit bank fraud, those elements are not self-evident. Even more so, with respect to aggravated identity theft, that's a complicated set of elements that go on that. In fact, the Supreme Court has had to weigh in on what that statute requires. And the Supreme Court has described the aggravated identity theft by saying the statute imposes a mandatory 2-year prison sentence on individuals convicted of certain other crimes if, during and in relation to the commission of those crimes, the offender knowingly transfers, possesses.
Can I slow you down just a minute?
Yes, ma'am.
We're on plain error on this, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, nobody said anything to the. He had counsel there, right?
He had counsel.
And nobody objected or anything. And did they, did the court ask counsel if he'd reviewed and everything with the defendant?
He asked him if he had reviewed the plea agreement with the defendant. He did not ask him if he had reviewed the indictment with the defendant or if he had reviewed the charges with the defendant.
Did he not also say that they reviewed possible defenses?
He did, Your Honor. And yet, that doesn't establish that the facts of the case were married up with the elements of the charges. And I want to say
we can look at the proffer and we can see if the proffer contains material that supports each of the elements. And it seemed to me that it did. It was pretty explicit with respect to what he did with respect to UO. And what he did in terms of carrying on the conspiracy.
I agree, Your Honor, that the factual basis was adequate to support the guilty plea. However, that is a separate and independent requirement of Rule 11.
Well, let me ask you this. Did the factual proffer also satisfy all the elements of the offense? I know your claim is he was not told the elements, mm-hmm. but isn't it undisputed that the factual proffer, I'm looking at it, it's 7 pages, does set forth facts that satisfy all elements of the offense?
I believe that is the case, Your Honor.
Okay.
Nevertheless, unless the defendant understands how the facts relate to the law of the case, a plea cannot be considered voluntary. And that's what the Supreme Court said in Boykin versus Arizona.
Are there any cases that say that in taking a guilty plea, you have to set out the elements of the offense? I mean, if there was a case that said that, that would be strong. But if the issue is from the record and on plain error from the record, does it appear that the material was put before him? Is there a specific case that holds that that's a requirement?
There are cases that say either the judge or someone else has to let the defendant know what the appropriate, what the elements are, what the law is. And I want to note that
from the 11th Circuit cases, you have a Guitti that seems to sort of support the government side. Gaddy might go the other way. And if you look at them, this one seemed a lot closer to Guitti to me.
Well, I would note that Guitti is an unpublished disposition, whereas Gaddy is a published binding case. And so I think that distinction is quite important. And in Gaddy, the court said that the defendant receives real notice of the charge when he's been informed of both the nature of the charges and its elements. Gaddy does say the elements should be described, need to be described, either by the court or by counsel. And in this case, I want to point out the omissions from the record. In many cases, the plea agreement will serve the function of setting out the elements of the offense. Not so in this case. The plea agreement simply said that he was pleading guilty to conspiracy to commit bank fraud and aggravated identity theft and listed the statutory codes. Typically during the Rule 11 colloquy, the defendant will ask if the defendant had an opportunity to read the indictment and discuss it with counsel. Not so in this case. In this case, there was some questioning about the discussions the defendant had with counsel, but none of it went back to the fundamental charging document or the elements of the offenses that were charged. It's unusual that was never addressed. And then, of course, Rule 11 requires the judge to inform the defendant of the charges against him, the nature of the charges, and that didn't happen in this case. This is what the judge had to say about the charges that Mr. Presendue was pleading guilty to. Count one charges you with conspiracy to commit bank fraud in violation of Title 18 United States Code, Section 1349. Count 31 charges you with aggravated identity theft, and it names a statutory section. And so the record shows
What do you understand and from the factual proffer that the... And you just said those facts constitute conspiracy to commit bank fraud. That were the facts that do that. As I understand it, your client knowingly took checks and cashed them, knowing they were either bad checks or somebody else's checks. He wasn't entitled to cash them. I mean, that's what happened. Your client physically took checks. I mean, that's what he admits in the...
Yes, Your Honor.
What does he admit he did that constitute... The proof of the crime. I know you're talking about he didn't know the crime. He didn't know the elements.
It's as Your Honor describes it, that he took checks. He knew that they were not his, and yet he cashed them.
He not only knew they're not his, he knew they were bogus checks or with falsified driver's license with false information on them.
Yes, Your Honor.
They were as bad checks as you can get, and he knew that, right? And he
admitted yes, Your
that.
Honor.
And he took them to the bank, hundreds of them. Not just one or two,
He disputed, actually, during the Rule 11 proceeding,
how many does he admit?
He didn't admit a specific number, Your Honor.
But let's say he admitted more than 50.
It was a good number of checks, Your
okay,
Honor.
Okay, so he's right. taken
but,
all... Wait a minute. I just want to understand what your client did know, because he was... What was his education? I know you don't want us to look at it. He wasn't an illiterate person.
He had a high school education.
Yeah, there was no question about his mental capacity.
No, right? No one questioned his mental capacity.
And so what does he admit? He took the checks, and he knew they all had identity theft on them. They weren't who they were, right?
Well, I disagree with that assertion. The record shows that he told, and I will say, the factual proffer shows that he told the person who was cashing the checks that, you know, this one has a real driver's license. Before, I wasn't giving you real driver's licenses. It says that he said that to the person who was buying the checks. Now, I would submit that that doesn't mean that he actually knew that these people were
but
real.
There are other places in the proffer he admits that he knew this was a false identity.
He knew that it wasn't him.
Okay.
But he does not
You're
admit
over your time.
Anywhere.
You've answered my question.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're
no, it's, that's my
disregard.
Fault.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bergendahl?
May it please the court. John Bergendahl appearing on behalf of the appellant, Scarly Jean. In our brief, we've raised four separate sentencing issues. There are two of the issues where our contention is that the district court misapplied the appropriate standard in number one, determining the loss amount that was attributable to Ms. Jean, and secondly, in denying her our request for a minor role. Those are the two issues that I would like to orally address before the court this morning.
With regard to the loss issue, Mr. Bergendahl, one of your arguments, not the only one, but one of them is that with regards to jointly undertaken criminal activity, the district court could not have and should not have included the check amounts for Ms. Farr. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And your part of the argument as to her is that she came into the conspiracy after Ms. Jean was gone or had ended her involvement.
Judge, Ms. Farr actually was in the conspiracy well prior to Ms. Jean coming in, and then again after an extended hiatus, reappeared at the very end of the investigation. And during the interactions that she had at that point in time with the undercover operative who was the check casher, made it clear that she no longer had any association with the individual she had been involved with before, which was Mr. Presendu. And at that point in time, she was pursuing her own venture, which was to cash some checks that she, along with her girlfriend, with an accountant, had come into possession of. The first check along those lines was a bank check, cashier's check, in the amount of $54,000.
You're talking about Ms. Farr?
I'm talking about Ms. Farr, yes. Now,
let me simplify this. There was $84,000 of the Farr activity, that's right? About
approximately
$83,000
of the FAR activity.
You just, as I understand all of your argument on the loss amount, you want that out, and you want the loss amount to be around $109,000.
That's absolutely correct.
You don't contest the $109,000.
We do not.
Okay.
No.
And you really analogize this to the guidelines discussion of two independent mules who are carrying drugs, and they're doing them at different times, even though they may be doing them in relation to some bigger boss, but they don't know about it or they don't deal with them separately. Is that the analogy?
One of the examples that I cited from the guidelines had to do with an individual who was the girlfriend of a drug supplier. And on one occasion, she agreed to go ahead and transport drugs for the individual. I cited that case to demonstrate that there is a significant difference between the conspiracy and jointly undertaken criminal activity. And it's the jointly undertaken criminal activity that really the court had to focus on and did not do so here.
Since there wasn't an objection, we don't know all of the reasons, but the best hook I saw for the government was the reference by Ms. Jean about getting checks from tax. She had guys with tax people, something like that.
Right, Your Honor.
Is there any connection of that to Farr?
No, Your Honor, because by that point in time, Farr was out of the picture, and Farr makes clear, the tape recordings make clear that were played during the Duran Soler trial, which is part of this case, that Mr. Presendu had a disagreement with Farr over who was going to get proceeds, and Farr disassociated herself from Mr. Presendo. When Ms. Jean came into the picture, there were a couple of individuals that she was getting the checks from, and the record supports this. One of them was Mr. Presendo, and the second one was Mr. Durant Solaire.
Are either of those tax people?
Actually, both of them had their own independent tax consulting services that were capable of generating those. Yes, Your Honor. The odd thing is that 4 days, 5 days after Ms. Jean was sentenced, this identical issue was raised by Mr. Durant Solaire at his sentencing. And there, the district court judge, based upon the same evidence that is in the record, concluded that Mr. Durant Solaire should not have been held accountable for the checks that were presented by Ms. Farr, and held him accountable only for $109,000. Those are the checks that were presented by Ms. Jean and subsequently by Ms. Durant Solaire.
Is the problem here the district court viewed your client as a participant in the overall conspiracy and rather than making fact findings with regard to her role? Is that the problem here?
That's one of the problems, Your Honor.
Because there was conflicting evidence, would you agree with me, about her role?
There was conflicting evidence in the sense of, I'm not sure I follow Your Honor's question.
Let's say on one hand, there was evidence she described herself as a boss with independent access to checks and negotiated her own share of checks. But on the other hand, there's some evidence she didn't really operate her own tax fraud company. I mean, there's just evidence about her being involved in some things, not in other things. And so the district court should have made some fact findings about her role.
Yes,
Your Honor. Is that really what needs to happen?
That's one of the things, Your Honor. And there, but at the end of the day, there absolutely in this record is no evidence connecting Ms. Jean to Ms. Farr and Ms. Farr's activity.
That goes to the loss amount.
On the loss amount, yes.
Okay, forget about the loss amount. I'm talking about Roe. Why wouldn't it be correct to say basically the district court didn't make any fact findings about role or didn't support. He just denied them, denied a minor role. And it needs to have some fact findings about what her role was compared to other conspirators in order to have it. You're not saying as a matter of law she gets a minor role. Is that correct?
What I'm saying is, Your Honor, that there was an inappropriate process that was employed.
You're not saying as a matter of law she can't get it. You're just saying the way he went around or she did it was inappropriate here.
Yes, Your Honor. At a minimum, the case needs to be remanded so that the court can apply the appropriate legal standard.
Let's see if anybody else has any questions. You're over. Okay. Thank you, sir. For the government, please. Mr. Colon. Is that correct?
Good morning. Jonathan Colon on behalf of the United States. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm going to start with Mr. Presendo's plea and then have some time to talk about Ms. Jean's sentencing issues. As to Mr. Presendo, Your Honors, you have the transcript of the plea colloquy and the factual proffer, and I think it's very clear from this transcript that there is no showing. There's nowhere in the transcript where Mr. Presendo shows any kind of confusion, lack of understanding. He repeatedly affirms his ability to communicate well with his attorney and understand his advice. They talk about having discussed the case in the plea.
But how can you show a lack of understanding if someone doesn't tell you what's at issue?
I think this is a very...
There's no reason, no good reason, why Mr. Presendo wasn't told either by the AUSA or in the plea agreement or by the district judge the elements of the offense, right? There's no good reason for that.
Well, Your Honor, I think I want to be very clear about what was told and what wasn't told.
No, I know it was told. He was not told the elements of the offenses.
He was not told that these detailed facts he admits constitute the elements of the offense.
He wasn't even told what the elements were. He wasn't told that aggravated identity theft, for example, requires another charge, that it has to be the identity documents of a real person, so forth and so on. He wasn't told any of that. He wasn't told the elements of a bank fraud conspiracy at all either, right?
You're right, Your Honor. He was not told that in order to be convicted of aggravated identity theft, you need to admit to facts A, B, and C. But as in Wiggins, he admitted specifically in great detail using all of the key words to A, B, and C.
Right, but my, and I'm not saying this is reversible error, Mr. Colon. What I'm saying is that you can admit to a state of facts, but unless you know that those facts constitute a crime, you might be out in left field. You may be in the dark. And I'm trying to figure out why in the world he wasn't told the elements of the offense. This is not like causing damage to government property where someone, you know, kicks something inside of a government office and causes damage. These are relatively sophisticated offenses.
Well, Your Honor, the words that he does admit to are words like unlawful, unauthorized. I mean, there is no confusion here that he knows he's admitting to facts that are crimes. He uses those words in his factual proffer.
Right, but counsel, I mean, you're, as a U.S. attorney, presumably you're involved in a lot of these. Is there some practice of not telling the elements, or is, in effect, this is just a case where the judge either forgot or thought it was so clear that some part of the usual script didn't get said?
Your Honor, forgive me. I am really not familiar with the procedure used on a regular basis, and I don't want to speak beyond
my
knowledge.
I thought perhaps
certainly this is something we can pay closer attention to.
One other question, which is there anything in the record, the complaints, the briefing, where defendant indicates that, oh, I wouldn't have pled guilty if I had known X or Y?
Not at all, Your Honor. In fact, when he's asked specifically, are you pleading guilty to conspiracy to commit bank fraud and identity theft because you are in fact guilty? And he says yes.
No, but I'm referring to the pleadings post guilty plea where they now raise these issues, which they didn't raise before the judge, but they say, and if we had known that, I wouldn't have pled guilty. I mean, I'm raising Dominguez-Benitez, which seems to say that.
His appellate brief, Your Honor, asks as a remedy either that he be allowed to withdraw his plea or get resentenced. I'm not sure how he gets to that. He is asking to withdraw his plea.
Okay.
But I think it's very clear when he... I mean, his
I know on appeal he is, but in the district court, this is a plain error review.
Did he
make a motion to withdraw the plea in the district court?
Not that I recall, Your Honor, and if he did, I apologize.
If I'd known all of this, I wouldn't.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And
we'll ask Ms. Hayes that when she gets before we got up here on plain error review. I assume that's why it's plain error review, because he didn't go to the district court and say.
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
Withdraw my plea, and he also didn't say in the district court through a declaration or his counsel saying it. That if I'd known what the elements were, I would not have pled guilty.
I do not recall any such statement or argument in the record.
Let me go back so you can. Are you saying you're just an appellate lawyer? You don't take pleas.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I apologize for not looking into that issue myself.
You need to tell them to get a script. Okay, I had a script. I was district court, and you just say you're charged with violation of United States Code section so-and-so. In order to prove you guilty, the government has to show A, B, C. I tell you what, my prosecutors would put it in the plea agreement. They'd set forth the what you had to plead guilty to, what the elements of the offense are, and have a defendant sign. It is no reason we should be doing this today. Absolutely no reason. I'm just speaking for myself.
I assure you, Your Honor, we've heard
it. It makes two of us.
Plea agreement. It would be in the plea agreement. I had to make sure, because you've got so much work, you need to convey this directly. To make sure you have so much work, I have a script. I almost know it by heart, but you can skip something, you can forget something. And I made sure I did the script, and I made sure I had the elements of the offense. It's just no excuse for it. And if the judge not do it, the prosecutor should hand the judge, say, please ask the defendant this so I don't have to go to the 11th Circuit. It'll take 5 minutes, Judge. It's just no excuse for it.
I assure you, Your Honor, we have
heard
you.
It's just very frustrating.
Yes, Your Honor. Unless there are further questions about Mr. Prezendu's play, I think the record shows his careful attention to detail, including reserving the one fact he did not want to admit to, whereas the other facts in great detail show both his detailed knowledge of all of the facts that embody the elements of the offense, as in Wiggins, and his knowledge of their illegal nature, and therefore his plea and his conviction should be affirmed. Unless there's anything further on Mr. Prezendu, I'll turn to Ms. Jean's sentencing.
Okay. On that regard, there seems to be an error in the loss amount, as he talks about, that there's no connection between her and Ms. Farr. Ms. Farr was at the end after she had completed, and there's no way she should be held responsible for that $84,000, but they've stipulated to $109,000. So why shouldn't we remand on that?
Your Honor, I want to address the court to the judges, the district judge's particular findings as to what Ms. Jean's jointly undertaken activity was in this case, and that's at page 14 and 15 of the sentencing transcript. And I think the fact that Ms. Farr's involvement changed over time and how the district judge treated that is instructive as to the attention the judge made as to what Ms. Jean's responsibility should be. As we all agree, Ms. Farr was involved earlier on in the conspiracy before Ms. Jean joined, because Mr. Prezendu, who introduced Ms. Jean herself into the conspiracy, Mr. Prezendu had previously been working with Ms. Farr's tax services. Ms. Jean was not held responsible for that, for either for those tax services, for Ms. Farr's actions, or even Mr. Prezendu's before. Ms. Jean is held responsible for her jointly undertaken activity once she joins the conspiracy. And what her jointly undertaken activity with Mr. Habib was to procure fraudulent checks obtained through fraudulent tax preparation services and to keep the conspiracy going by introducing new members into Mr. Habib's operation. That is the finding that the district court made, and this is on page 14 and 15 of the transcript, and the district court's application of those facts to the guidelines, as counsel says, the district court sat through the trial of Mr. Durant-Solaire. The district court was very familiar with the ins and outs of this conspiracy. Those findings are entitled to some deference here. He understood, the trial judge saw, that Ms. Jean's role wasn't
He took facts from the trial and applied them here?
He doesn't cite particular facts in the trial, but he notes, having sat through the trial of Mr. Durant-Solaire, I'm familiar with this conspiracy. Words to
you
that
can't,
effect.
But you can't do that.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You cannot do that.
He doesn't apply a particular fact in the
trial. You cannot use fact-finding from another proceeding for a defendant who hasn't had the opportunity to be present and challenge those facts.
I think perhaps I'm using imprecise language, Your Honor, and let me try to correct what I'm suggesting. You can look at the transcript yourself, and you'll see what the judge says. But what the judge is saying is, I understand this conspiracy, having been the one who's been hearing the cases of all the co-conspirators. And Ms. Jean, what the judge finds is that Ms. Jean's activity, he makes findings about her particular undertaken activity, and says her activity was to introduce new members into this conspiracy. This was not a street-level drug mule. That would be a different case if we were trying to say that every street-level drug mule is responsible for every other. That's not this case. Ms. Jean worked directly with Mr. Habib to expand the conspiracy. This is like the case
How is she introducing new members when, as Ms. Farr, because Farr was already involved previously? How would that be a new member of the conspiracy? She wasn't a new member.
No, I want to make sure I'm being precise. Ms. Jean did not introduce Ms. Farr. Ms. Jean brings in her own relative who's involved in bringing checks. She brings in Mr. Durant-Solaire, who continues the conspiracy. By continuing the conspiracy and working directly with Mr. Habib to do so,
so you're saying if Habib's dealing with John Farr, that she's still responsible for that?
Yes,
even though she's not involved.
Because her jointly undertaken activity is with Mr. Habib to expand the operation.
Well, help me with this, though. I thought she had withdrawn and stopped at a certain point before Mr. Habib got Ms. Jean back in.
Again, I want to use precise language. Ms. Jean herself disclaims any formal withdrawal. We're not talking about a withdrawal from conspiracy.
All right.
We are saying that Mr. Habib says to Jean, I don't want to work directly with you. So Ms. Jean says, okay, I can bring in Mr. Durant-Solaire, who will work with you sort of on my behalf. At a certain point, Jean and Duran Solera's relationship deteriorates. But Ms. Jean very specifically has an undertaking with Mr. Habib, okay, you won't talk to me anymore, but you're going to talk to Duran Solera, and this is going to keep things going.
But how does Farr get involved in all of that?
Later on, Duran Solera, I'm sorry. later on, Farr comes back to Habib, and I believe...
Independently of John?
Yes, Farr and John do not deal with each other.
So how is that jointly undertaken criminal activity?
Because what has to be jointly undertaken, it doesn't have to be each individual person has to make a specific individual agreement. Jean's undertaken activity is with Habib. It is to continue Habib's operation. She's dealing the case in Petrie and in White, a case that the defense attempts to distinguish on page 6.
So everybody that Habib dealt with after that point in time is attributable to Jean?
As long as it is within the scope of Jean's undertaking with Habib and reasonably foreseeable to continue their operation.
What's the undertaking?
To procure fraudulent checks obtained by tax preparation services.
With no limitation?
Yeah. I suppose there could be some case.
Habib could have reached out to another state and gotten other people there to do that, and Jean would have been responsible for them too?
There could certainly be facts. Another state, 10 years hence, where that would be so far removed. But that's not this case. Jean, this is the same store. This is the same operation. This is tax. This is checks obtained by fraudulent tax preparation. That is what Jean undertook with Habib and kept it going. And it is reasonably foreseeable to Jean that when she helps keep Habib's operation going, that he has other people working for him too. This is not a case where she's just some, street-level mule who's not dealing with the boss or helping the operation go. This is someone working directly with the boss. The case in Jean's reply brief at page 6, she attempts to distinguish the case of White by saying, well, in that case, the person was dealing directly with the tax filer. Well, that's this case. In this case, Jean is working directly with the check casher and therefore is responsible for other people's checks, just as in White, the defendant was held responsible for other tax filers, check cashers, even beyond herself, and even who she did not have any direct dealings with. It is not required that Jean have direct dealings with Farr. What's required is that Jean had jointly undertaken activity with Habib.
Help me with this. Where did Farr operate out of physically? Are they all out of the same office, or are they in different physical locations?
I'm not aware of Farr's location, but Habib's location is the same. Habib runs a store, and people come to him with their checks.
Okay, and does Farr come to that store, or does Farr off somewhere else doing it?
My understanding is that Farr came to Habib at Habib's location, the same location.
I thought Farr had a separate tax prep.
Farr generates checks from a separate location, just like Jean generated checks from a separate location.
Okay, that's what I was trying to get at.
Habib is the lead person.
Okay, but Farr and Jean are at different locations.
Yes.
Generating the bad checks.
Who then bring them to Habib, the central.
So anybody who came to Habib at that period of time, John is responsible for. So if there was somebody that Habib and John didn't even know about, but they walk into Habib's store and say, I got some fraudulent checks to cash, and they get cash, she's responsible for them?
I believe it could be, Your Honor. I believe there could be cases so far removed, but Farr is not so far removed. Farr was someone who worked with Prezendu, who brought Jean into the conspiracy. Farr was there before.
Is there any indication that Jean and Farr even know each other or know of each other?
Nothing that I saw on the record, Your Honor. As to the minor role, I will just brief up. I can have a few seconds to briefly cite you to pages 27 of the transcript, where I believe there were findings as to Jean's particular role not being held for the conspiracy in general, but her own actions the district court makes findings of on page 27. And unless the court has any further questions, we ask the court to affirm both Mr. Prezendu's conviction and Ms. Jean's sentence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Hayes?
Thank you.
Did your client file a motion to withdraw in the district court?
No, Your Honor.
And has your client filed any declaration, anything saying, if you had told me these elements, I would not have pled guilty?
No, Your Honor, but for the purpose of his due process challenge, he was not required to do that.
I'm not saying he is. I'm just trying
yes,
to get
Your
record.
Yes, Your Honor, of course.
And your statement there relies on what in Dominguez-Benitez, that it only talks about Rule 11?
Exactly, Your Honor. In fact, it specifically says that it's important to note that that case did not present a due process claim. It specifically says that, and it limits its application to Rule 11. And back in Henderson versus Morgan, Supreme Court case, the court said that any assumption that the defendant would have entered a guilty plea is not important to the constitutional analysis of plain error. I want to tell the court that it's not extraordinary in this district. It is not extraordinary for the district court not to explain the elements of the offense to the defendant. I read a lot. I don't do the trial work myself, but I read a lot of plea transcripts. And this omission is very common. I also want to note that...
So what do you attribute it?
I
just rushed to
I'll tell you to what I attribute
rushed
it.
To take a plea?
I attribute it to as an unexpected consequence of plain error review and the requirement for Rule 11 errors that everything will be affirmed anyway. And so there's no course correction here. If the court, and it goes across different judges, there's no course correction. Nobody comes back, the court never comes back and says, this is mandatory, you need to do this. It's been a long time since that message has been given in terms of an 11th Circuit opinion. Now we've reached the magnitude in this course of a constitutional due process error because there simply is no record that this gentleman has ever been given this advice. And it's time for this court to give the message now, both in the constitutional context and Rule 11. If you have no further questions, I'll ask you to reverse Mr. Prisendue's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hayes. Mr. Bergendahl, you have two.
Focusing first on the incorrect calculation of the loss amount, the government repeatedly makes reference to Ms. Jean having an agreement with Habib, but at the time that Ms. Jean was dealing with Habib, from a pure conspiracy law standpoint, she could have no agreement with him because at all times when Ms. Jean became involved, he was already a government agent and acting under the auspices and the direction of the case agents. Number two, what the record really shows is that Ms. Jean, the scope of her jointly undertaken activity was that she was going to go in and cash some checks for Mr. Prisendue and for Mr. Duran Soler. Because as the record developed, Duran Soler made an admission that the checks that Ms. Jean had brought to the Quick Stop, some of them belonged to Prisendue, some of them belonged to Duran Soler. By February of 2014, after Mr. Duran Soler becomes directly involved, he becomes suspicious of Mr. Habib, doesn't want anything further to do with him, and at that point in time, everything insofar as Ms. Jean is considered is functionally, factually, and legally over. It's not until 4 months later, June of 2014, when Ms. Farr reestablishes contact, and at that point in time, she makes it clear, I'm here on my own. This has nothing to do with Prisendue. I don't want anything to do with him anymore. I have no relationship. I want to start fresh with you, Mr. Habib, and I want to go forward from this point.
Counsel, if we agree with you on the first point as to the loss amount, which then, in effect, limits the activity to the interaction between Jean and Habib, is there any way she could be a minor participant in that? I mean, doesn't that undercut any notion that she is now a minor participant in that limited activity?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it does, because in order to properly analyze whether or not an individual is a minor participant, I think the court has to go ahead and take a look at Amendment 794, which was not in effect at the time that Ms. Jean was sentenced. But because it's a clarifying amendment, it is in effect now. And I think it makes clear that in order to go ahead and determine whether or not a person is entitled to a minor role, you have to go ahead and you look at their conduct within the jointly undertaken criminal activity and compare it with everyone else.
That's good enough for me.
Unless there are...
Yeah, it's just not a... it's like the drug, even though they had the drugs, you don't just equate it to the drug amount they held responsible for, is what you're saying. You just
correct.
You still got to do this separate analysis. May end up in the same place, but you still have to do it.
Yes, and the district court made a rather poignant comment.
I think we have it, and your time has expired. I'm sorry, we have to... I gave everybody overtime, so... We need to go to the last case, and thank you, Mr. Burke.